Mountain, Island, Lightning Bolt, Spell Pierce, Switchblade, Stab Wound, Red Mage, Blue Mage.
Hey.
Hello.
Welcome. Welcome to Red Mage, Blue Mage, starring yours truly, Kenny. I play blue.
Hi. It's me, it's Amber. I play red.
How are you feeling today, Amber?
Whatever. I don't know.
It's
not the
energy I'm looking for.
Look,
out the gate.
I can't be anything other than me. Like, you can't get me to be whatever. Like, this is what you get, and I am feeling very whatever.
Well, we'll see what we can do to change that over the course of this episode. Are you excited about today's topic?
What was the topic?
1 second. I need to do a costume change. Put on my shades, because we're talking about the bad boys of magic today.
Wait, what?
We're talking about bad cards.
Okay, I thought you were talking about, like, oh my god, don't fucking scare me. Jesus lord.
This is how I'm going to get your energy levels back up, is like with a dose of fear, just some adrenaline pumping through your veins.
No, I don't like that. When you say bad boys, I was like, oh no, was I supposed to pick like criminal cards? I just picked cards I thought were bad.
Yeah, no, that is exactly what we're doing. We're talking about the stinkers of Magic the Gathering. We're talking about the bad cards. In my head, you should have playing in your head right now, bad boys, what you gonna do?
But they're except, not criminals!
Except bad cards. But they should go to jail. That's the point.
Why? Why should they? Okay, you know what? Anyway, this is a pick a card segment, right? So I should be
yes.
playing the pick a card music. So pick
yes.
a card
save, music. Save those thoughts for later.
Pick a card music. Bump.
Pick a card. You son of a bitch.
All right. Well, with that auspicious bridge, let us pick some cards.
All
so,
right.
As always, the topic is pretty loose. Pick your top three, favorite three, whatever, bad cards in Magic. And usually, as we talk about it, we wind up discussing what for us, what the criteria is, what makes these bad cards.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
So this was your topic, so does that mean I get to go first?
It does mean you get to go first.
Okay, so in third place, so I actually have two cards here, because...
Classic.
You'll see in a minute.
Oh my god.
So... As I was looking through, like, people's, like, you know, lists of top worst cards or, like, what they think are bad or whatever, and of course, people have been doing this for a long time, and I have very little magic knowledge, so I can't just go, oh yeah, from my time back in here, I remember this bad card. I have to rely on people who are already in the community playing things and have put it out there. But, I mean, I do, like, understand the basic tenets of, like, what makes a card bad. It usually has to do with, like, the efficiency of mana cost and, like, what the card actually does. Does it even have value? What kind of format are you playing? That kind of stuff. How would you use it? And so I was noticing a lot of cards on these lists had a lot of stuff that it just, the mana cost for what it did to play it, then if there was any other like things that added mana plus tapping like abilities, they weren't just worth it because it didn't make sense to play it. So the first one I saw this that I was like, oh, this is obvious, is Obelisk of Undoing, which sounds like it could be a cool card and with one mana cost,
one
it could be
mana
cool.
Cost.
Yeah, so it's an artifact and you're like, okay, cool. I got cool art. Good job, Tom Winterstrand. Winterstrand? I can't read.
Vonnerstrand.
Vonnerstrand. Okay, anyway. Sounds fun, costs cheap, it's an artifact, but then you get it out into play, and then you have to have six other colorless mana to tap only to return a target permanent you control to your own hand. Which is like, okay, why would you do this? I mean, I can understand why you would want to have a card come back to your hand, because, you know, maybe there's an enchantment on it or, you know, somebody's done something to your card and it has a really good, like, enter battlefield effect that you want to, you know, keep doing. But this costs 7 mana to do that. So, yeah, you get it out early sure, put down your obelisk of undoing on your first turn or whatever, but someone's going to get rid of it, or you have to wait six more potential turns before you could get to use it, and then you're just taking a permanent off of your battlefield and putting it back in your hands. That means you're going to have to pay for the cost of that permanent again to play it. So it seemed pretty ridiculous. And so
glacially slow.
Yes. And it's also a situation where it's like you would have to have a specific thing in mind. It's not worth it. It's not efficient. So that's my first one. The one that's sneakily hiding underneath, which I will pull off to the side and then also delete this. is Cephalid Snitch, which cost one colorless and a blue. So two cost. It's a creature. It's a Cephalid Wizard. It's 1/1. So already two mana for a 1/1 creature is pretty silly. Also a weird tribe. But then when it comes into play, there's no like into play action. It's just has on it sacrifice Cephalid Snitch. Target creature loses protection from black until end of turn. It's so silly because it just doesn't make sense. Like, you're banking on somebody to have protection from black. Okay? Why? You're useless. You're not. I don't even get what you're snitching on.
The worst part about it too is that even if you are fortunate enough that somehow your opponent has a protection from black creature, spending two mana and a card to take that protection off, you still have to pay for a removal spell.
Yeah.
To hit them or whatever you're going to do. So you're still two for one-ing yourself. So even in the best case scenario that it has a target, it's still awful.
It's just not economically or efficiently well thought out. It doesn't make sense. The flavor of it doesn't even make sense. I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't matter. So I put those two in the same kind of category because to me they were basically cards that I saw were inefficient and playing a very specific game with not a very good like high rate of return essentially.
Gotcha. Okay, I was going to ask, like, what is the theme of these two? Because they feel like very different cards, but no, that makes total sense. It's wildly inefficient.
Yeah, because it's like, why would you put this card, why would you put Cephalid Snitch into your deck if, like, protection from stuff, to me, those cards are only good if they're, like, cover two colors. And even then, it's like...
It's not worth a card to remove
No, it's not. Anyway, that's my two for number three.
Okay, good pick so far. You found a brand new way to sneak in extra picks,
well,
hiding
you did
them
so,
behind each other.
Yes, well, you put this Google slide together, and I'm just working with what I got. So,
all right. Well, let us proceed to my third pick, which is one with nothing. This costs one black. It's an instant, very simple text box. Discard your hand. And then the flavor text, when nothing remains, everything is equally possible. Which I guess is true, i.e. you won't be doing anything after this. All of the nothing you're going to do is equally possible at zero.
Are there any cards that say if you have nothing in your hand, you win?
There are cards that say if you have nothing in your hand and nothing on the battlefield, you win. Like Barren Glory, I think.
Yeah.
This one made it to my list of favorite bad cards because of exactly what you are doing right now. I think you see this card, which is very clearly bad in almost any circumstance, and you're thinking... But how can I use it? Unlike the two that you showed, which are inexcusably bad cards, in my opinion.
Yeah.
This card is like, it's taunting you, it's teasing you. How do you use this effectively? There's got to be something there.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I can think of too. It's like, if there's something, But again, it's still along the same lines of Cephalid Snitch, where it's like you are banking on a scenario that is very, depending on your format, I guess, highly unlikely. Maybe more unlikely, but it's like, it almost like it's one of those, like, it feels like a faux combo card.
Yeah, it's like a trick combo card.
It's like a
card.
Trick combo card.
It seems like it should be a combo card.
Like, what should this go with? I could do something. It's a challenge, obviously. So, but yeah,
I think it's still possible. I think that there is potential for One with Nothing someday, some weird card to be printed, and all of a sudden, One with Nothing is like really impactful.
Yeah, but Obelisk of Undoing will never be impactful.
Probably not. Cephalid Snitch is gonna sit on the bench.
Okay, are you ready for my second place?
I am ready. Oh god.
So
this is a block of text.
So this is my second I didn't see very many cards in the whole like list of stuff that irritate me on the level when I have like rule blocks of text do. Like we've talked about before, maybe some that I think lost to time
in a lost episode.
In a lost episode of bad recording etiquette, and I was drooling at the mouth at Mephistopheles's something or other. I can't even say that. Whatever. I feel like
even the name is too long.
Yeah. Whatever. Anyway, so I found one though, and it is Sorrow's Path, which is a land card. It is a land card that you can put down and then you can tap. And let me read this for the audience. Choose two target blocking creatures and opponent controls. If each of those creatures could block all creatures that the other is blocking, remove both of them from combat. Each one of them blocks all creatures the other was blocking. Whenever Sorrow's Path becomes tap, it deals 2 damage to you and each creature you control. 1, you don't even get any mana.
Yeah, that's true. That's true a lot of these rare lands back in the day.
2, I'm assuming, like, on first read, when I first read this was like, halfway through the second sentence, I stopped caring. But I think you're just doing a switcheroo happening.
They did this a lot, I feel like, in the olden days, where they had an idea in their head that, and the idea is very simple to state, but then putting it in rules language is very hard. Like, Oubliette was like that.
Yes.
But this one is like, what it wants to say is, take 2 blocking creatures, have them switch the creatures they're blocking.
Yes. But because Magic, the Gathering's rule sets, runs like scripting program, if you don't write it in a... This is the knowledge that I have gathered over the 700 episodes we've done now.
Yeah.
That if you don't write it a certain way, it ends up... can break the game, or people find loopholes, or it causes problems. And to me, that sucks, because from a user experience perspective, like, this doesn't make... it's just so cumbersome.
Yeah.
And that's why I think when you start designing cards, and why I put this as number 2, why it just honestly it almost was my number 1 card for the personal for this very personal, like, professional reason, where it's like, you shouldn't have made this card. Like, the minute that it becomes like, if the whole gist of the, like, idea of the of this card is, we just want you to switch to 2 blocking creatures so that way you can make it block the, you know, kill themselves against your attacking creatures. And it has to be, like, 4 sentences long. There's a problem.
What was it really worth it, then?
Yeah.
Because the whole idea, what's satisfying is when you see a card that's supposed to represent something and you immediately go, aha, I get it.
Yeah.
And this prevents you from really doing that.
Yeah, and then on top of that, you also, when you tap this to do it, you end up hurting yourself anyway. And that's not to say that maybe one of those cards had trample or other things. It's like, when are you going to play this? Why are you going to choose to do this? And this, to me, is like, just no mana, hard to understand. You're hurting yourself and creatures. It's like, what's the point of switching up blockers if you're gonna do new damage to your creatures anyway? In what situation are you gonna your creatures gonna live past that? Yeah, you switched up the blockers and one creature lives, but oops, your sorrow's path has now killed it.
Yeah, it's like many levels of design failure, it feels like. From the text box to the effect to the land not giving you mana to the art.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on in the art. I think there's a wizard's sucking out the energy of a
or petrifying
person, or petrifying, yeah,
in a sand pit.
But in the background, there's like a pterodactyl on one side of a bridge over a very small chasm where people are poking each other with pikes. I can't really tell what's going on.
Yeah,
here.
It's a lot, and it doesn't communicate what this card
Where's
is about.
Where's the path? Is it the bridge?
I think there's the sand pit is a path. You can kind of see it winding away.
Nope. Oh, yeah.
I think maybe the idea that the art's trying to communicate is that there was a more sensical fight going on, and they all whoop, 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 switched around. Anyway, all very confusing.
Just questions upon questions here. All right, let's go see what your second place is.
All right. A more modern card. Archangel's Light. This was from Dark Ascension. This is 7 and a white, so 8 mana spell, for a sorcery, a mythic rare. You gain 2 life for each card in your graveyard, then shuffle your graveyard into your library. That's it. That's the card.
Puts 8 mana.
Yes, it is 8 mana. Now, you might recall a few of my friends, their favorite card in my cube is Elixir of Immortality.
Yeah.
Which is an artifact. I think it pays, this is off the top of my head, it pays 1 to play and 2 to activate. You sacrifice it. You gain 5 life. You shuffle it and your graveyard into your library. So it does like the same thing, but colorless and for 3 mana. So this card is really a joke. Yes?
It would just be sitting in your hand for a really long time.
Ages.
Before it would even, one, be worthwhile, or you could cast it. If you could do stuff.
And when is it ever really going to be worthwhile? Like, how much... This is a common question that people ask when it comes to life gain spells. Because life gain, if a card just gains you life, it tends to be pretty bad.
Yeah.
And so sometimes people ask the question, how much life would you have to gain on a card, just gaining life, before it would be worth it?
To me, it would be like, I would have to have at least 5 cards in my graveyard before I would want to play this.
And even then, 8 mana for 10 life.
Not really worth it. Yeah. I could be... putting fire lightning bolts in there.
Exactly. One of the reasons I like this card as one of my favorite bad cards is it has an interesting story. So this is coming in the aftermath of Zendikar, the original Zendikar standard environment, where they banned, imagine this, 2 cards for the first time in many years. And that was a big deal, though it is hard to imagine now. But they were gun-shy after that. They didn't want to print another disaster card. And this card, the card that was originally in this card slot, they couldn't tweak it. They couldn't get it right. They couldn't adjust the numbers. And they kind of ran into their deadlines. Like, we have to turn in a card in this Mythic Rare slot. We don't have time to test it. So they had to put in a card that was guaranteed not going to break a format. And so Archangel's Light was born.
Oh my gosh. So, okay. I hate that, but I also love that. I think it's sad, and I don't think anybody should be put in that position. So, can I take like a sidebar?
Yeah, please.
Into the distance?
Please, just get my beverage.
Nerd adjacent. I'm listening to a podcast right now called Newcomers, which stars... Nicole Byers and Laura Lampkiss, I believe was her last name. I can't remember. And they are two comedians who really only watch like reality TV and are now watching sci-fi and fantasy as new to the
big pop
genre. Yeah, movies. Right. And so I got done with the Lord of the Rings. They're listening through their Lord of Rings and they're doing everything, Kenny. They're doing... the entire first Lord of the Rings. They're doing the Hobbit trilogies, and they're doing all of the animated stuff as well.
I mean, I guess that would make for good listening. Yeah,
it's great listening, especially when you are so steeped in a genre. Like oh, I yeah. get all the tropes, but like what other people are, it's like getting used to something else. Like when you look at like cephalophid, whatever the fuck, snitch.
Cephalid
snitch. If you're magic, like I'm okay with accepting it because I have been in this genre for a long time. But somebody else would be like, oh my god, what the heck? And so that's what's happening. But what I'm trying to get to is, they are now at the Hobbit, and they watched the first movie, and Nicole absolutely hated it. But Laura kind of liked it because it was more kid-like. She was like, it was more fun. There was like more fun things. And the guest they have on, they always have a guest who is a fan or has done stuff with it. This is Red Mage, Blue Mage promoting another podcast right now. I swear this is a point to this story. So anyway, they learned from the new guest, one, they didn't know The Hobbit was supposed to be a kid story. That it was specifically written to be...
For his kids.
They didn't know that, like, it's shorter than any of the Lord of the Ring books, any one of
them.
By
far, yeah.
And then Laura dropped, they also do tidbits of stuff, and they dropped that she was like, well, that kind of makes sense now, because as I was reading, like, trivia for the movie, there's a extended stuff, like, video of Peter Jackson doing an interview, and he literally says that he was making stuff up on the fly because they had didn't know what to add. And then the guy who was their guest was laughing because he's like, oh my god, that's probably why Radagast is there. And what it's like, oh yeah, Radagast exists maybe for like two sentences. Let's go make up a backstory for Radagast. So anyway, I think it's sad and funny and terrible that things come to being. Although I think Archangel's Light was probably a lot less cheaper than a three-part trilogy for The Hobbit.
Yeah. I mean, the cost that they pay for it is they put out this card. I remember this card when it came out, people being kind of outraged that imagine you open up you save up your money and you buy a booster pack of Dark Ascension and you get Archangel's Light as your mythic.
It's a mythic rare. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the similar-ish kind of feel where it's like everybody who like loved The Hobbit and was hoping for that Guillermo del Toro two movie gonna be super fun romp, and you get
a bloated mess.
A slog of fucking battle and Legolas being Q-Bert, so, you know. Anyway, that was my side. I told you it kind of related. I just wanted to talk about...
You said this is Red Mage, Blue Mage promoting another podcast. This is actually a recurring segment. Amber talks about whatever she's watching or listening to and relates it loosely to magic.
Whatever. I'm a co-host. I can talk about what I want to talk about.
I liked it. I think it did connect.
Gosh. I have lots of thoughts about R&D and things. But, okay, let's talk about my first place. Picked this because it's just funny to me. It irritates me on a goblin, like a goblin level, because it's a goblin card. It's Goblin Firebug. It costs one and a red, and it's, like I said, it's a goblin. It's a 2/2, so a 2/2 for two mana. It's not the greatest. It's not
what it
horrible.
What is its ability? Could be great.
But anyway, when it leaves play, sacrifice a land. Now, I personally am fine with like life being sacrificed, creatures being sacrificed. That doesn't hurt me, but this goblin, why I would not put this goblin in my deck. It's a bad goblin. I usually love all goblins, even the ones that don't make much sense, but this goblin is gonna die. It's
a 2/2.
It's a 2/2. It's gonna die, and goblins are meant to go into the meat grinder.
They're fodder, yeah.
So he's just a huge liability for my mana, and I don't want him, and I'm very sad that this card exists. Why are you part of the ban Goblin Firebug? just out of principle.
Get this card out of existence.
Yes.
This is very, very similar to a card I'll talk about later in our next segment. So I'm glad you brought this one up.
It's irritating to me as a goblin, as a goblin queen.
As a goblin enthusiast and queen.
Yes, it makes me upset.
All right. I don't blame you.
So your turn.
My number one pick.
All right.
Another old card.
There we are.
Rhystic Cave also has to do with land and losing access to your land. Rhystic Cave is a land. It taps to add one mana of any color to your mana pool, unless any player pays one. So your opponent can just save a mana and deny you this land anytime they want to.
That's silly.
It's a land that allows your opponent to tap it down anytime they want, basically. That's pretty bad. I think the idea, I assume, when they made this card is that it's making a mana of any color and it comes in untapped, so it needs a big drawback, which is true. But
yeah, but make it pay a life.
Which they've made that card before. Sure. City of Brass, Mana Confluence. One life is very different than often you just don't get to use it at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, making a land that makes it so that you can't play the game is pretty awful.
It's not
so that's why this takes my number one pick as one of the worst lands of all time.
Like at a goblin that worst. A goblin that doesn't really do anything except destroy your land. That is
at least you have
goblin.
The chance of it attacking for some damage.
Maybe.
This doesn't give you much.
No, that's true. All right, cool.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. What's the next segment?
Next, I think it's time for some discussion. Civilized scholarship.
Once again, it's time for an academic debate between a civilized scholar and a homicidal brute. Let's begin.
Okay, I timed it out in my head. I think perfect.
Okay, whatever. I could actually play the music. I'm just being very lazy.
That's okay. Will it be there for the people?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Sure. Okay.
I'll put it in.
Okay, so I just want to talk about philosophically bad cards. And do you mind if I just give a little intro and then we can go where we want to?
Yep.
So where I want to intro this, the first place I really thought about it was Mark Rosewater in an article on Daily MTG at almost the very beginning. So this is an article from January 28th, 2002. And he opens this article, which is about bad cards. It's called When Cards Go Bad. And he opens it by saying one of the questions he gets the most often, which obviously is true, it's one of the first topics he addressed in his column, is why do Wizards print bad cards? Why do you intentionally print cards that aren't good? Now, you just made a face like, what the fuck?
What do you mean?
You made a face like this.
Well, yeah, I know.
Okay, I just wanted to see if there was a thought there.
No, I'm holding it. Keep going. Okay.
So he got this. He receives a very long and actually thoughtful letter from a fan who's asking the basic question, why do you print these cards? And he provides a long list of reasons of why bad cards have to be a part, quote-unquote bad cards, have to be a part of Magic. So I figure we just go through them and talk about them?
Yeah, go for it.
And then render our verdict?
Sure.
Number one, he says, by far, the most important is that all cards cannot be good cards.
It's very true.
Says if you have a pool of cards, some of them are going to be the best and some of them are going to be the worst, and those worst cards will be the bad cards.
Yep.
So an example people like to give, and I thought about when I first encountered this article, is like the cube, you know?
Yep.
Traditional cubes are built to be just a collection of the most powerful cards in Magic's history, and you will see if you draft them enough, there are cards that are consistently drafted last because they're the worst, they're the bottom of the barrel. You can go watch any pro Magic streamer do a cube draft, and they will routinely talk about cards and say, I don't think this card is very good. So, for example, one that I hear pros say is not very good is like Brainstorm, unless you can get a bunch of fetch lands. And Brainstorm's a great card normally, but there's all kinds of cards like that, all kind of mid-rangey cards that are great in Constructed, great in Limited, and are not very good in Cube. So that's his first point, is that If you make any collection of cards, there will be the best and the worst.
Yep.
So you buy that one?
Yep, 100%.
Okay.
Can't all be good. Well, then nothing would be good, or everything would be the same.
When everybody's super, no one is.
And when everyone's super, no one will be.
Whatever.
He also says in this same category here that it's all a matter of comparison. Like at the time, the premier burn spell was Volcanic Hammer. One in a red, deal 3 to any target at sorcery speed. And when they first printed it, players were like, this is awful. But they were comparing it to Lightning Bolt, which is 1 red, instant, deal 3. But you know what? Volcanic Hammer saw a lot of play because in the formats it was legal in, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on context. Number 2 reason Mark Rosewater gives. Different cards appeal to different players.
Correct.
So there, when you open a pack of Magic cards, there are cards in there for all kinds of different people. You've got drafters, you got people who are trying to open cards for Standard or Modern or Legacy or whatever, even Vintage nowadays, that can happen. You've got kitchen table Magic players, you know, kids just getting into it, like me. Sure, Enormous Baloth is not a good Magic card, but I loved it. When I was first opening it, 7/7 for 7 mana, hell yeah.
Remember I was getting all those big booty turtles? I don't know why I grabbed them, but I did. It's big old butts I could hold on to for some reason. I don't know. It was a really weird time, aka the beginning of the pandemic.
But yeah, so, you know, if basically he's saying, if you think a card is bad, take a moment to think, is this card meant for someone else? Would somebody else get a kick out of this?
I agree.
Number 3, diversity of card powers is the key to discovery. So he's saying that when you play Magic, part of the fun is doing your own exploration and seeing and finding out what is strong. And if everything is like on the same general scale, then how can you really make discoveries about what is good and what is not good? You can't.
Right.
He makes an analogy. He's like, when you play Uno, part of the game is not, you don't have to evaluate that a draw 4 is better than a blue 8, because you're not choosing which cards you get in your hand. You're not choosing what cards go in the deck. Magic, you get to pick the game pieces. So an important part of the game is being able to discern the game pieces.
Yep. I also agree with that.
4. This is kind of a repeat from the number 1 point. Power levels are relative. It all depends on the context. Okay. There are cards like One with Nothing, let's say. Or he gives the example of Lion's Eye Diamond. Lion's Eye Diamond is, it's like an adjusted, it's like a nerfed Black Lotus. Hmm. It's a 0 mana artifact. You sacrifice it and you get 3 mana of any color, but you also have to discard your hand. Hmm. So obviously that's much worse than Black Lotus. But actually there are ways to break Lion's Eye Diamond, and it's an extremely good card. When they printed it, people were just like, this is garbage. So it all depends on the context.
Yep.
Number 5. Diversity of power rewards the more skilled player. So basically, this is another like one that goes with an earlier point, is that the best players are better at differentiating good cards and bad cards, even in situations where it's not so obvious. So me and Seth kind of have been learning about that when we're doing our Filthy Casual reviews, where we're trying to rate the cards in a new set and compare how we did to LSV and Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And they're obviously much better at figuring out which cards are going to be good than we are. And so having a big differential in the power level allows for players at different levels to be able to do that. Number 6, this kind of goes to the One with Nothing thing.
How many numbers does he have on this list?
There's only 2 more, 6 and 7.
Oh my god, okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'll try to speed it up. Players like finding hidden gems. It's fun to find and break a card that no one else thought was good.
Sure, okay.
Number 7, R&D is only human. They're going to make some cards that are a little too underpowered.
Yep. I agree. The reason why I made the noise I did or the face that you called out at the beginning was because everybody who has listened to this show or has going through will hear how much of an R&D background I have. And it's one of those things where people like to question, well, why does X happen? And it's always, and I don't roll my eyes. It's just very exhausting. And I applaud Mark for making his list. But yeah, like to me, it's when you have a limited perspective of something, and you, even though you are the consumer of said good, you don't have the same kind of perspective as somebody who is behind the scenes working on these things, and developing these things, or understand your perspective outside of your own experience, your own personal experience with the game. So when he talked about the cards aren't always made for you, right? There's different types of players, different cards appeal to different players. It's the same with products in general. Right. Why does somebody buy X thermos versus, they're all thermoses. Why is one thermos better than the other? What's important to that person at that time? Was there that color option? And to also think that some people do play for aesthetic or jank reasons for Commander, and it's a very highly customizable game. Yeah, it makes sense. Like, if I wanted to make a whole Cephalid deck for some reason, I could potentially do that if I wanted to. And fuck, yeah, I don't care. Get that Snitcher in there. He's got that name on it. I'm just going to have fun with this deck. Another, like, I like the last point too, where it's like, we're only human. I think sometimes people forget, because of their limited perspective, because of their distance from the field or whatever, that there are human beings working on things, and they are capable, just like you, just like anyone else, of making a bad decision or making a mistake or not thinking things thoroughly. For instance, we just talked about your number two pick, that angel card or whatever it was, the life gain mythic that's not worth it. Right. It's just like, we ran out of time and it sucks. But what are we supposed to do? We don't, you know, and then here you've got this shitty card. It happens. It sucks. But just because you're working for a corporation doesn't immediately erase the humanity of the person who is working for that corporation to get a paycheck. I am very passionate about this. I am not the corporation I work for. And I'm not a machine, and I'm not a computer.
Would you agree, like you said, it doesn't erase the fact that you're a human being, your human flaws. Would you agree that sometimes it can even amplify it, because you wind up with, like,
yes,
team think, committee think?
You also end up with outside pressure. Right. Things come up, problems come up. Like in my day-to-day business, you know, it's like I need to work on X writing, and I'm trying to write. And I'm getting phone calls because they found a typo in something else that needs to be fixed right now. Okay, well, I have to put this thing on hold and then start working on this to correct mistake. But because I put that thing on hold and got confused while they're talking to me and I get interrupted, that just heightens my level of making a mistake. And it's not a person's problem. It's a system problem. But because you have human systems making things like rules and games, unfortunately, there are going to be mistakes. It's going to happen. But I also agree with Mark when he was talking about, you just need that variety. Like, not everything can be an A+ card. You know, you have to have your baseline. Well, you hope to have just a baseline. It works. It's not broken, which unfortunately is not a thing currently happening in Magic stuff right now, but baseline, you want it to work, but that's your baseline. Like, it works well within the rule set, and it's okay, it's not whatever, that's what you hope for, and then you go up from there. Because those big booty turtles, they were waving their butts around. I just wanted them for some reason. I don't know. It wasn't the greatest card, but I took them anyway. I don't know. Whatever. I made a mistake because I was tired and also dealing with a quarantine. Anyway, have I talked enough?
No, I like that. Especially like the point you made where you said, you were talking about like somebody could make a Cephalid tribal commander deck or something like that. It reminds me of a video that I think I showed you from TCG Player, Pretty Dece. There's a guy talking about the worst magic block of all time, in his opinion.
Yeah.
It came after, right after Urza's Saga. I forget which set that was. It's an old set. Had a bunch of bad cards in it. Rhystic Cave, my top pick, came from that. Mm. And he was just talking about, that's when he started playing the game, during this set with all these awful cards. And it makes him really nostalgic. And he actually built a commander deck that was all cards from that block. And it's like intentionally like an awful deck. And he's like, I just want to play these awful cards and remember them and try to politic my way to getting second place every single game.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
That's fun. It's fun.
Jank is fun.
Yeah, it can be. It's just so silly. I mean, it's a silly game anyway. I mean that in the with the most love and respect
possible.
It's just funny.
I do, before we sign off here, I want to address one thing, because my thinking on this article has changed a little bit. I tend to agree very much with Mark Rosewater and with you about these issues. And I remember reading it the first time and just like enthusiastically nodding and be like, no, you're absolutely right. Like, there does have to be best and worst cards. You're right. In the cube, there are cards that routinely go to the end. But thinking about it more, especially thinking about the cube next to a normal limited environment, there are cards that I would call bottom of the barrel. But the bottom of the barrel cards in cube tend to be very narrow or very niche or answers to a particular thing. Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of cards, and none of the cards are dead. Like, there's no card in there that you just couldn't play in a deck. Whereas there are cards routinely in every single format that gets released that are just kind of dead cards. Now, some of those dead cards are dead for reasons because they belong in different formats. Sometimes they're meant for different people. But I do think there are still a handful of cards at the bottom of every set that don't fall into any of these categories that are just kind of bad.
Are they bad in the sense that they are not competitive?
They're bad in the sense that they don't belong anywhere, I would say.
Like, can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
I think, like, for example, your Goblin Firebug would be a perfect example of that, where even you, the Queen of Goblins, the number one Goblin fan...
He was a mistake.
He should never have been.
He should have never been, honestly. The cards that I'm thinking of, for me, that is a mistake card. That's a card that someone made, they designed it, they didn't really think it through, it got put in. I don't think that was, like...
It doesn't show a pattern.
The cards that I'm thinking of that I'm like, I don't really care about are usually those ones that are like, they're defenders.
Right.
Or they're like a 2/2 cat or whatever. Right. To me, those cards are meh. Not what I'm looking for, right? Like, as a Magic the Gathering player. But for somebody starting out in Magic, those are great beginner cards because that's your basic Magic tenets, right? Attack, block.
Sure.
And people who are just getting into Magic, kids or other, you know, whatever, you can start Magic whenever. I think those cards have their place as learning tools for the core game when you're playing on a different level, the newer level, introductory Magic, right? So those are the cards that I'm thinking that are, like, get sifted to the bottom when you're like playing competitive. Like when you're drafting, they have their place in booster draft. Let's just say that.
Sure.
Usually your last pick.
Sure.
That could end up in your deck if it makes sense, because I've had it where all of a sudden people had all these flyers. I'm like, fuck, I gotta put these spiders in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone's got flying and I'm going to put these reaches in my sideboard and then lo and behold, I need them.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's so context dependent, I feel like. I feel like, yeah, the ones we listed at the beginning truly don't make any sense really in any format. Like, why would you want Rhystic Cave? Why would you want Path of Sorrow? There's no good for it in any format unless you can somehow find a broken ass combo where it could work, which is going to be very rare, but that's part of the fun discovery, right? Like we talked about how the whatever discard your hand card, it's
that could be,
it's
you
intriguing
can see potential there.
Like, what could I do to combo a win, right?
Right. It's but there are cards like Rhystic Cave where there is no potential. There's no
right,
combo.
Right, exactly. Unless something comes out that's like, if a player pays one to negate your card's ability, they explode.
Lose the game.
And then everyone's going to be like, Rhystic Cave! And MTG Finance is going to go crazy and buy up all the Rhystic Caves.
So yeah, if you keep your eye on MTG Finance and you see Rhystic Cave shoot up, you know there's a player explosion card
yes.
on the horizon.
Right. But I'm just saying, it's like, even then, it's like, those weird cards maybe could be something later on, whereas I feel like the Goblin is just... Unless you had a card, again, that's like, for every time you lose a land... your opponent blows up, you know?
Sure.
And it becomes something. So I even then it's like, maybe this is just my hoarder mentality. Like, I keep every like little box that I have, and I keep every
little sticker.
Who knows
if this might have a use someday.
Right? Why do I have 700? Okay, I shouldn't be making light of hoarder stuff. I shouldn't be making light of it. I'm more of a pack rat. So I just want to be very like cognizant of that, because I'm not a hoarder, true hoarder, but I do have the tendency to save things because of my grandmother, who is a true hoarder, kind of instilled that on us. But yeah, like, maybe it's just me trying to find inherent value in something, potentially, but it's very unlikely. I think Path of Sorrow has no place in Magic.
Bad cards do exist, yeah. And I think you can point to some bad cards and say, these were mistakes.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, Rosewater acknowledges that too. His last category is a catch-all. It's like, we make mistakes sometimes.
It happens, and I can.
What you gonna do?
I can completely empathize with that. It happens. It's even with a
for
committee,
because sure.
especially in, that's why I talked about it earlier on in other episodes, where I'm like, well, I wish they could have an outside perspective, but leaks are such a scary thing for Wizards that I get why they. Don't really do that, but hey, I'm good with signing an NDA. I don't know. I don't have any Magic Magic card design knowledge, but just saying.
You'd be a good case study for like the Goblins. Like, are you excited about this Goblin? Maybe you wouldn't be good because you would say yes to basically everything.
It depends. Not for Goblin Firebug. He's.
I guess that's true.
I didn't even sacrifice him. I just put him in a corner and gave him a Nintendo Switch and said, "Don't move."
Bad Goblin Mom.
No, just a very like he's sheltered. he has a life that is very cushy, and very safe. And he's kind of a brat, but I don't want him out in the world, doing things.
What's his name?
Sheltered. He's the sheltered one.
Well, with the image of sheltered in our minds, I think is a good place to sign off for today. We've been talking for a while.
Yeah, well, you get me talking about R&D, and then, you know.
That's the secret.
That's the, yep. Anyway.
All right, well, thanks for joining us today. This has been Red Mage, Blue Mage. You can find us on Twitter at RedBlueMTG. I've been Kenny. You can find me on Twitter at Wolfmere.
I'm Amber. You can find me at Rocket Orca.
And until next time, I'll be representing Counterspell.
And I'm feeding sheltered Cheerios by the spoonful. Bye.
Goodbye.